Welcome back, everyone. Today we're exploring something truly fascinating, the rich world of Kurdish mythology.
It's a really captivating area full of complex narratives and beliefs shaped by centuries of history.
Absolutely. We'll be looking at various sources to understand the core stories, the beliefs, the cultural expressions, and, you know, Kurdistan's position historically right at a crossroads of civilizations is key here.
Definitely. That geography has led to this incredible mix of influences. Think ancient Mesopotamia, the Hittites, then Mithraism, Zoroastrianism, Judaism, Christianity, Islam.
It all feeds into it.
Exactly. It creates this, well, really complex and syncretic cultural tapestry. You see it so clearly in groups like the Yazidis and the Yarsun.
And to really get a handle on this, we have to talk about the oral tradition, right? Zargot.
Oh, absolutely central. For centuries, Zargotan was the way this knowledge, the myths, the history, the culture was kept alive and passed on.
Through the Dengbej.
Yes, the Dengbej. These traditional singers, storytellers, often they couldn't read or write, but they were like the living libraries.
That's a great way to put it.
They memorized and performed just vast repertoires, epics called Destan, Tales or Sirak, Songs Stran, even Lament Serbia, everything from big battles to, you know, intimate love stories.
The resilience of that tradition is just something else.
It really speaks volumes.
And we should probably acknowledge, studying this hasn't always been easy.
No, definitely not. There have been political constraints, sometimes skewed perspectives from outside observers. Real challenges.
But things are changing. It feels like there's more focus now.
There is. It's really encouraging to see this flourishing of Kurdish folklore studies recently, often led by Kurdish researchers themselves, which is vital.
And it's not just about looking back, is it?
Not at all. This connects directly to current efforts in, say, Kurdish language revitalization, asserting cultural sovereignty. It's about reclaiming indigenous knowledge, challenging those older dominant narratives, you know?
Makes perfect sense. Okay, let's start with some foundations. Maybe the Yazidi creation story. Our sources shed some light there. Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Yes, the Yazidi cosmogony is quite unique. It doesn't start with chaos like some others. It begins with this primordial emptiness, just God, Exwid, or Ezdan, or Pedcha, existing alone.
Okay.
And from his own light, God emanated this this white pearl, Adur. And he stayed within it for, well, a very long time.
And the angels.
Right. From that same divine light came the seven divine beings, the angels, known as the Heptad, or Heftsir, the seven mysteries.
And Tawusi Melek, the peacock angel, is the leader.
Yes, the primary figure among them. He's the leader, the main intermediary between God and, well, everything else.
Are they like the archangels in Abrahamic faiths?
There are parallels drawn, sure. But within the Yazidi view, they're seen more as emanations of God's essence. And often they're known by their earthly manifestations, like Sheikh Shems, who's linked with the sun.
Interesting. So how does creation actually happen from the pearl?
God commands the pearl and it splits open. From it flows the primordial sea. Then come the heavens, the earth, sun, moon.
And humans, other beings.
According to some accounts, yes, angels like Yadin were involved in creating humans, animals, and so on.
Now, what about those texts, the Meshef HaResh and the Kitev HaSilweh? The Black Book and Book of Revelation.
Ah, right. That's a complex point. These texts surfaced later, claiming to be ancient Yazidi scriptures detailing creation. But while many scholars question their authenticity, the thinking is they might be later compilations, possibly incorporating ideas from outside traditions as Yazidism interacted more with the surrounding cultures.
So it highlights the difficulty of studying a primarily oral tradition when written texts appear later on.
Exactly. And what's really striking is how different this Yazidi cosmology is from, say, the standard Abrahamic creation accounts.
Our sources mentioned possible links further back. Mesopotamia. Pre-Zoroastrian Iran.
Precisely. Some see echoes of ancient Mesopotamian ideas, maybe even the Anunnaki, and certainly older Iranian beliefs that might predate Zoroastrianism as we know it.
Which suggests Yazidism might preserve some very old religious layers from the region.
That's a strong possibility, yeah. Now, if we shift slightly, there's another creation narrative mentioned in the myth of Shamaram.
Right. The sources compare this one to the Garden of Eden story.
Yes, and it's interesting to look for those structural parallels. You know, fundamental stories from nearby cultures often share certain frameworks.
So what are the key points of comparison?
Well, the analysis highlights this coherent underlying structure in both. They're focused on the creation of existence, the creation of humankind. There are elements like a paradise, sort of Eden-like, and this overarching creation theme.
So even without all the specific details of the Shamran myths laid out here, identifying it as a key Kurdish creation story and seeing these structural links, it suggests maybe some ancient cross-pollination of ideas in the Near East.
It certainly points in that direction, very suggestive of that kind of exchange. Okay, so what about the origins of the Kurds themselves, mythically speaking? Seems like there isn't just one story.
No. Our sources lay out three distinct sets of legends.
Okay, what's the first?
One tradition connects Kurdish origins to, believe it or not, King Solomon and jinn spirits. This pops up in early Judaic and Islamic histories.
Huh. Jinns. That's fascinating. It sort of weaves the Kurds into that broader tapestry of Near Eastern legends, though maybe that reflects an outsider's view.
Could be. Then there's probably the most famous one, the link to the tyrant Zahak.
Ah, Zahak, with the snakes growing from his shoulders.
That's the one. Often portrayed as an Assyrian king in this version. The snakes demanded a daily sacrifice of young men's brains.
Grim stuff. But the story goes that someone, maybe Kawa the blacksmith himself in some versions, or just compassionate cooks, saved some youths.
Exactly. They substituted sheep brains and sent the young men off into the mountains to hide.
And according to Ferdowsi's Shahnameh, the great Persian epic, those youths became the ancestors of the Kurds.
Right. And that whole narrative is tied up with Kawa the blacksmith's rebellion against Zahak.
Deeply intertwined. Okay, what's the third origin story?
This one focuses more on tribal ancestry, specifically mentioning the Milan and Zilan tribes, suggesting maybe two main branches of Kurds originally, who then dispersed due to some kind of divine anger.
Interesting. So supernatural unions, heroic escapes from a tyrant, tribal divisions.
It's quite a mix. And the fact that these different stories exist side by side really says something about the complex identity formation of the Kurds, doesn't it? And the region being such a cultural melting pot.
Absolutely. It reflects that rich, layered history. Okay, so from origins to the divine, what about the Kurdish pantheon? What do the sources tell us?
Well, predictably, it reflects that same complex history. You see elements from ancient Iran, Mesopotamia, Abrahamic faiths, even Sufism.
Makes sense. Where should we start? Maybe back with the Yazidis. They offer a good example of this complexity.
Good idea. So central for them is God Iksuidi, who is transcendent, sort of remote. But the active force in the world is Tawusi Melek.
The peacock angel, leader of the Heptad. We mentioned him.
Right. And there's also this idea of a divine triad.
Yes. God Tawusi Melek and then Sheikh Adi ibn Musafir or Sultan Ezid. Their identities seem closely connected, almost overlapping at times. And below them, you have the Sudans.
Sudans.
Sort of divine powers or beings associated with specific aspects of nature, mountains, springs, things like that.
Okay. Then there's the goddess Ana or Anahita. It's associated with water, fertility, protecting women.
Yes, and her roots seem to go way back, likely connected to the ancient Iranian water goddess Ahadisura Anahita, who's mentioned in the Zoroastrian Avesta.
And traces of her worship might have survived.
It seems plausible. You might see echoes of her in, say, female deities among the Yarsan or Yazidis, figures like Khatuni Razbar or Pir Fatima, perhaps even linked to certain shrines or holy springs venerated by women in different Kurdish communities.
It really shows the depth, the historical layers.
Definitely. And if we zoom out to the broader Iranian context, you have that ancient Indo-Iranian split between Ahuras, the good deities, and Devas, the demons or evil spirits, and of course key Zoroastrian figures like Ahura Mazda, the wise lord, and Angra Mainyu, the destructive spirit.
And some scholars think Yazidism and Yarsanism might actually represent something older than Zoroastrianism.
That's a significant theory, yeah. Scholars like Philip Cranbrook argue they might preserve forms of ancient Iranian religion that weren't fully incorporated into Zarathustra's specific reforms, so potentially offering a window into pre-Zoroastrian beliefs.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Rojbosh Hannah.
Ah, perfect timing. Rojbosh.
Oh, Hannah, this smells absolutely divine today. Hmm. It's got that lovely aroma. Let's see. Hmm. It's got that perfect balance, you know. Maybe just a tiny hint of bitterness today, so I might add a touch more sugar. But honestly, it's wonderful.
Let me try mine. Sipping sounds. Oh, yes, very good. Smooth, maybe a tiny bit bitter, like you say, but I like it that way sometimes. A welcome pause.
Definitely. Hmm. Let's just take a moment here. Okay.
Right. Where were we?
Mythical creatures. We cover deities now for the beasts and beings of folklore.
Ah, yes. Kurdish lore seems full of them, and again, links to wider traditions.
For sure. Many have relatives across Iran and the Near East.
Mm.
Take the Simurgh or Samir in Kurdish.
The giant wise bird from the Shahnameh.
Exactly. Features in the Avesta, too. A very ancient, benevolent figure. And in Kurdish folktales, like the ones about Mirza Mihemid.
He's the hero we'll get to later.
Right. The Simurgh often shows up as his rescuer, a powerful, positive force. Then there's Shamaran.
Chief of snakes, part human, part snake.
Usually depicted that way, yeah. With a woman's head and a serpent's body, she's associated with great wisdom, secrets of the earth.
And central to that creation myth we touched on earlier.
Exactly. Very important figure. And, of course, you can't talk mythical creatures without mentioning dragons of the Ajda.
Connected to Zahak again. Yes, the term itself links back to ancient Indo-Iranian dragon myths, and Zahak embodies that. But Ajdaha also just appear as, you know, classic dragon adversaries in folktales. Monsters to be overcome.
Got it. Any others?
Well, there's the Alan, a folkloric spirit, sort of a personification of puerperal fever, the dangerous fever women could get after childbirth.
So a feared figure. Are there ways to protect against it?
Traditionally, yes. Things like wearing iron bracelets, certain charms or rituals were used to ward off the Al. And finally, we mentioned the jinn earlier in relation to those King Solomon origin legends.
Right. So it's clear there's this through line connecting Kurdish folklore to the wider mythology of the region, but with its own unique twists and adaptations.
Precisely. Local color, local beliefs shape how these figures are understood and portrayed. Okay, shall we talk heroes?
Let's. Kurdish mythology must have some powerful, heroic figures.
Absolutely. Top of the list, arguably, is Kawa, the blacksmith, Kawa Isinger.
The one who rebelled against Zahak?
The very same. He's the ultimate hero of liberation. His victory is so central, it's directly linked to the Newroz festival, celebrating freedom from tyranny and the renewal that comes with spring, a massively important symbol.
Then there's Mirza Mihemid. You mentioned him with the Simurgh.
Yes, Mirza Mihemid, sometimes Mehmud. He's like the archetypal fairy tale hero in Kurdish Sirak, the folktales.
What kind of things does he do?
Classic hero stuff, really. Journeys to the underworld, battling dragons or monsters, rescuing princesses, and often getting crucial help from the Simurgh. His stories often fit that international folktale type, ATU 301, The Three Stolen Princesses.
Interesting. And Memnon-Zen. They sound important.
Oh, hugely important. The tragic lovers from Emine Vzani's epic poem. It's a beautiful, heartbreaking story of love thwarted by a villain named Beko.
But it's more than just a romance.
Much more. It's often read as a powerful allegory for the Kurdish nation, divided, oppressed, longing for unity and freedom. Mem and Zin symbolize that yearning.
Wow. And who else? Any figures borrowed from elsewhere?
Well, Rustam Izal, the great hero from the Iranian Shahnameh, also appears in Kurdish contexts sometimes. And his connection to the Simurgh, who helped raise him, often carries over too.
Okay, so let's dive a bit more into these big narratives, starting with Kawa and Zahak.
Right. As we said, this isn't just ancient history. It's foundational for Kurdish identity today. The connection to Newroz is key.
The bonfires.
Exactly. Mm. Lighting the bonfires on Newroz Eve is seen as a direct reenactment of Kawa lighting fires on the mountains to signal his victory over Zahak. It's liberation, renewal, the start of spring, all rolled into one powerful ritual.
And Memnon-Zen. Emine Vzani's epic.
Widely considered the Kurdish national epic. We touched on the story, Memnon-Zen, their love, Beko's treachery leading to tragedy. But those layers of meaning are crucial.
The romance, the allegory.
Yes. It functions as a deeply moving, tragic romance. But also, for many, it's read through a Sufi lens. The soul's longing for the divine, represented by the beloved. And maybe most significantly in modern times, as this potent symbol of Kurdish national aspirations.
And Zani writing it in Kurdish? That was a deliberate choice.
Oh, absolutely. Writing this major work in Kurmanji Kurdish in the 17th century was a conscious act of, well, cultural nationalism, asserting the dignity and capability of the Kurdish language and culture.
Okay, beyond those epics, what about the wider world of folktales, the Sirakh?
It's incredibly rich. The Mirza Mihemid cycle we mentioned is just one example, very popular, especially where Kurmanji is spoken. It fits international patterns, but feels distinctly Kurdish.
And people are collecting these now.
Yes. There's been a huge effort, especially in recent decades, by Kurdish folklorists, people like Ahmed Berry, Ibrahim Emedi, Lokan Nadarpur, Haider Lotfinia, many others, to record and publish these tales before they disappear. Journals publish analyses of them, too. Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
That's so important. And figures like Shamaran, they appear in these folktales, too, not just the creation myth.
Definitely. Her legend is retold in various forms, deeply embedded in the folklore beyond just the cosmological aspect. Okay, maybe we can pull together some threads now about comparative mythology and religious syncretism.
Yeah, how do all these elements connect? We've seen links to ancient Iran and Mesopotamia.
Clearly. Figures like Simurgh, Ashtaha, potentially Anahita, they have deep roots in Iranian traditions. And those suggested parallels between the Yazidi Heptad and the Mesopotamian Anunnaki, while maybe speculative, are certainly intriguing.
And the relationship with Zoroastrianism seems, well, complicated, not just a simple offshoot.
No, not at all. As we noted, the idea that Yazidism and Yarsinism might preserve pre-Zoroastrian elements is quite compelling. It suggests they represent older strata of Iranian religious thought.
Which makes Yazidism a really fascinating case study in syncretism.
Absolutely. You have this monotheistic core, but it's blended with ancient Iranian and Mesopotamian cosmology, the Pearl, the Heptad, Tawasi Melek, plus significant influence from Islamic Sufism, particularly around figures like Sheikh Adi. It results in unique rituals, a distinct social structure.
And a complex relationship with broader Kurdish identity, too.
Yes, that's multifaceted. Which brings us to that concept of Yazdanism.
Proposed by Mehrdad Izadi, as a kind of ancient religious unity among Kurds.
Right. He suggested that Yazidism, Yarsinism, and perhaps Kurdish Alevism shared a common pre-Islamic religious system, Yazdanism, or the cult of angels.
What were the supposed core beliefs?
Belief in a transcendent god, but with worship focused on seven angels, or divine beings, led by Melek Talis, the peacock angel. Also, a strong belief in reincarnation and the idea of successive divine manifestations on earth.
Is this widely accepted?
It's debated among scholars. While the similarities between Yazidism and Yarsinism are undeniable and point towards some shared ancient roots, the overarching Yazdanism framework, as Izadi proposed, it isn't universally accepted. It's also become tied up with aspects of modern Kurdish nationalism, trying to emphasize ancient non-Islamic roots.
I see. So how does all this mythology live on today? In rituals, festivals?
Very much so. Nuraz is the prime example, reenacting the Kaaba myth with the bonfires. But think of Yazidi practices too, the pilgrimage to their holy site at Laylish, their daily prayers facing the sun, the baptism rituals, the various festivals, the chanting of their sacred hymns, the quills. It's all deeply tied to their cosmology.
And those possible Anna-related rituals, holy springs.
Yes. Traditions involving women visiting specific holy springs or shrines might preserve echoes of that ancient goddess worship. And even protective customs, like warding off the ale spirit after childbirth, are drawn directly from folklore. Mythology informs daily life and life cycle events.
It really shows how these stories aren't just stories. They actively shape cultural practice, which leads to the idea of folklore being a cornerstone of Kurdish identity, Kurdieti.
Absolutely central. It's a source of collective memory of history, especially kept alive by the Dengbej.
It provides a foundation for national consciousness.
Yes, particularly from the 20th century onwards, influenced partly by European ideas of romantic nationalism, but drawing on these deep indigenous roots. And think about the symbolic power.
Kaaba as resistance. Emuzin as the divided nation.
Exactly. These myths and epics become powerful symbols for expressing resistance, longing for liberation, national unity. In times when overt political expression was suppressed, folklore provided a vital language.
A form of cultural resistance and survival.
Precisely. And it can also shape social norms within specific communities. Think of the Yazidi caste system, or concepts of honor found in some narratives.
So how did this tradition flow through time? We know oral tradition was key.
Primarily oral for centuries. The Dengbej, as we've said, but also religious specialists like the Yazidi Kuwals who recite the sacred texts. There's a huge range in oral genres, epics, tales, songs, proverbs, riddles.
But then it starts getting written down.
Right. There was some early interest from European travelers and scholars. Then, in the early 20th century, Kurdish nationalist figures like the Bedirkin brothers and journals like Hawar started actively collecting and publishing folklore as part of building a modern national identity.
And that effort continues today.
Massively so. There's a real surge now in collection and publication, often by Kurds within Kurdistan and the diaspora. The motivations are clear. Preserve this heritage, revitalize the Kurdish languages, challenge those imposed narratives, document their own history.
And even religious traditions are becoming more textual.
We see a gradual process of scripturalization happening, for instance, within Yazidism, as oral hymns and traditions are being compiled and written down more formally.
And finally, scholars are engaging more deeply now, too.
Yes, it's become a recognized field of study. You have scholars like Diana Rostaminas-Hadden, Joanna Bacheska, Ferengis Gaderi, Christine Allison, Philip Krayenberg, Mikkel Liesenberg, Garnik Asatrian, Victoria Arkilova, Kana Omarkali. many dedicated researchers publishing in specialized journals, bringing anthropological, historical, linguistic perspectives.
Which helps give us a more nuanced picture than perhaps was available before.
Definitely. Moving beyond some of the older, maybe less informed or biased accounts, Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Okay, so wrapping up our exploration today, we've journeyed through some incredible territory. The creation stories, the Yazidi cosmology, the pantheon with figures like Tawusi Melek and Ana, the mythical creatures like the Simurgh and Shamaran.
And those major narrative cycles, Kawa the Liberator, the tragic depth of Memuzin. We've touched on the syncretism, the ancient roots in Iran and Mesopotamia, the unique development of traditions like Yazidism.
And it's so clear, this isn't just stuff for the history books. This mythology, this folklore, it's alive. It's in New Rose. It's in Yazidi pilgrimage. It's in the stories still being told.
Absolutely. It's fundamental to collective memory, to national consciousness, a symbol of resistance, a focus of ongoing preservation and study. It still resonates powerfully.
Which leaves us with a final thought, perhaps. In our digital age, with everything changing so fast, what is the future for these incredibly rich oral traditions? How will these ancient stories continue to inform Kurdish identity and culture, both in the homeland and the diaspora?
That's a really important question to consider. How does tradition adapt and endure? It's something we see cultures grappling with worldwide. Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Indeed. Well, thank you for joining us on this exploration into the fascinating world of Kurdish mythology.